Hello and welcome to The Breakdown, the RTE Rugby Podcast. I'm Michael Corcoran. Shortly we'll hear from Gareth Tubridy, the Tournament Director of Women's Rugby World Cup 2017. The Connacht coach Pat Lamb looks ahead to a rather busy few weeks for the province. And we're also joined by the Guinness Rugby Writers Player of the Year, CJ Stander. But first, a chance to relive extended highlights from the Aviva Stadium last weekend when Ireland hosted Australia.
Back with Conor Murray, moves it to Zeebo, pops it up now towards CJ Stander. CJ Stander carries that, gets run straight there at Tavita Kuridrani. Murray moves it back, chance for Ian Henderson. Henderson goes forward with that now, carries it about 2 yards towards the 10-metre line. Murray desperately trying to get his hands on it. The referee blows the whistle, penalty against Australia just on their own 10-metre line. Paddy Jackson then with his 10th start for Ireland on his 19th appearance. And he lines up this penalty outside the 10-metre line, 17 in for the touchline on this near side of the pitch. And Paddy Jackson then, slightly distracted by Jerome Garce, is having a conversation there with Michael Hooper. And Paddy Jackson then, with the chance, as he comes up now and kicks this one, nudges it towards the post, and it's gone straight between the posts. Ireland into the lead, 17 minutes gone, 3 points to nil. Available here for Australia now, and they've got numbers as Ireland are under pressure now as they try and get the tackle in just on the 22 far side. Will Guinea towards the inside field runner here, and that was Rory Arnold. Rob Simmons there to help him out as well, tried to bring it there towards the 22-metre line. The ball is now knocked on, the referee's whistle has gone, and there's a bit of afters there because there was an Irish player dumped onto the ground by an Australian who suspiciously looked as if he was actually on the other side of the ruck.
Yeah, well, I think what happened, Tadhg Furlough was looking to go in and poach Dean Mum in trying to clear it, lifted his legs. Now, the question is, did they go beyond the horizontal? That was certainly the crowd seemed to think so. Referee is going to check this upstairs.
Yeah, so it is definitely a penalty. You may have a look to see if it's any more, yeah. Okay?
Lift Nigel Owens there. Is there. Man alive. That's Dean Mum. He lifts him up. Here,
Rick,
please.
Jerome.
He's going to get a card. It's a definite yellow.
Yeah. It's not going to be a birthday card, I can tell you that much, because he lifts him up. And there's no duty of care there by Dean Mum. That's the reality.
Top of the shoulder and after. But he's low. There is two players, so for me, it's a yellow card.
It's a yellow card.
Against which?
Six gold.
It's going to be a yellow card.
I have to say I agree with that. It isn't as if he was trying to clear it out on the body. It's not from a high position. All the issues surrounding tackles, we've already seen a number of players, as you said, Michael, sent off today. Argentina had one, I think, after 4 minutes. So everybody's a little bit nervous around the whole tackle area at the moment. And I think Dean Mum will be quietly pleased that he's only got 10 minutes.
Murray gathers it now, sweeps it towards Jackson, lets it inside towards the team captain. Rory Best, who has control of it now, midway between the 22 and the 10-metre line. Back with CJ Stander, who literally runs through Will Guinea, brings play towards the 22. Conor Murray has it, moves it away to his left-hand side. Paddy Jackson to Zeebo, gets that, kicks it along the ground in towards Earls. Gathers it now. Earls pops it up. There goes Henderson. Goes to the line. Ian Henderson with the try. The referee blows the whistle. There might have been a suspicion of a forward pass, to be perfectly fair about it. 23 and a half minutes gone. I wondered why Zeebo was kicking the ball. Then I saw Earls. Then we saw Ian Henderson, and he's gone right through the cover, and he has scored his third international try for Ireland.
Well, a good try there for Ian Henderson, and here comes Paddy Jackson now with the conversion opportunities inside the 22-metre line, 20 metres in from the touchline on this near side of the pitch. We're in the 25th minute of the game, and Paddy Jackson now with the conversion chance for Ireland as he absolutely belts that one. It kicks it straight between the posts. Remember, it's Australia with 14 players on the pitch. Dean Mum in the sin bin, 25 minutes gone, and it's Ireland who lead by 10 points. The line-out throw for Ireland, 6 metres short of the Australia line. On this near side of the pitch, Rory Best with the line-out throw goes over towards CJ Stander. Gathers that, and Ireland swarm around him. Australia tried to disrupt. They have done so, but it's back here. Conor Murray with the pass back to Paddy Jackson. Spots it in the gap. Goes to the line. Almost stumbles over and scores the try. And that came from absolutely nowhere. It was Gary Ringrose who pushed Paddy Jackson out of the way, gathered the ball and staggered towards the line, expecting somebody to challenge him. Nobody did, and Gary Ringrose has got his first international try for Ireland. And here's Paddy Jackson now with the chance to add some additional points for Ireland. And Jackson comes up now and snaps that one. But I'll tell you what, Paddy Wallace was kind of wincing there as he kicked that, because he did make not a great connection, but it was an effective one. Back towards Tavita Kurindrani. Australia have it on the Irish 10-metre line. Will Guinea moves it out there now, and it's available here for Hooper. Hooper pops it across, and Australia have it now inside the 22 as they go charging for the line and get in under the post. Dane Haylett-Petty, the only fella from Western Province, has scored a try for Australia under the post just before halftime.
Well, that's a warning. All Australian teams, they never give up. You have to play for 80 minutes, and the genius that we spoke about, the individual bits of brilliance, just some superb play. Again, a set-piece play off a line-out. They scored off three line-outs against Wales, and again, it's just their lines of running, a burst in midfield, and a superb offload. Haylett-Petty in the right place, scoring under the sticks.
Well, the score under the post by Dane Haylett-Petty, his fourth international try for Australia. And here comes Bernard Foley now with a conversion attempt, literally on the stroke of half-time. He's right in front of the post. He gathers that one, and that sort of simple kicking style of his nudges it straight between the posts. And the match referee, Jerome Garces, blows the half-time whistle as the teams leave the pitch here at the Aviva Stadium. But it's Ireland who lead at half-time by 17 points to 7. Stephen Moore now shunted back. Ireland holding out just about for now. Back there with Will Guinea, moves it back, and Australia now look as if they've almost an extra man on the pitch as they come charging with that one. It's Will Guinea sweeps it away to his left hand side. Ireland now, and the ball has gone out on the near side of the pitch, and it's touchdown on this near side, and it's a try for Australia in the corner on this near side of the pitch.
Yeah, magnificent passing there from Australia. Just the simple things. Well, take the pass, draw the man, put the other player into space. Tavita Kurindrani, that's his fourth try in four games on tour, and really it was a case of Ireland just running out of numbers, and Australia executing really well under pressure.
And Bernard Foley now with that magnificent kicking style of his, and that one just about dropping over the post, and we're back to a 3-point ball game, 17 against 14. Josh van der Fleer slightly slow to get up. Here comes Tadhg Furlong now, smashes away past two Australians, brings play towards the edge of the 22. Kane Douglas in on the wrong side. I'm sure he thought he must have been playing for Ireland there. A referee's whistle has gone, and it's a penalty against Australia for not rolling away. That penalty from Ireland really brought about by the strong work by Kieran Marmion and Tadhg Furlong on that occasion. Here comes Paddy Jackson with the penalty for Ireland. Jerome Garces having a sort of a running conversation there with players. It's rather off-putting, I would have thought, for kickers, having a running conversation with players as their opponent is lining up a penalty kick. And here comes Paddy Jackson now with the penalty for Ireland. Jerome Garces having a chat there with Stephen Moore. 9 minutes, 17 seconds gone. Second half as Ireland look to try and slow down the tide of Australian pressure. And Paddy Jackson comes up now and nudges that one between the posts. A much better kick, and it was a badly needed score, Paddy.
Well, much needed, much needed. 15 minutes of pure waves of Australian goal coming at Ireland. Needed to change the momentum there. Great effort from Keith Earls, as Donal mentioned. Switch the momentum, and Ireland have points, and back to a 6-point game.
And Australia still maintain possession. Good work there by Australia, who have it inside the 22, across on that far side of the pitch, and they get through the Irish cover, and Australia have got in for the try across on that far side of the pitch, and Ireland have been absolutely torn apart there by Sifa Nayabalu, his first touch of the ball just a couple of minutes after coming onto the field of play.
Yeah, well, I did make the point, this guy is electric. He's only come in, it's his first try for Australia, his fifth cap. He's been outstanding in Super Rugby, but again, it's almost a numbers game. Brilliant execution from Australia. They managed to suck in the Ireland cover defence. They're passing under pressure. It's been fantastic.
Here comes Bernard Foley with the conversion opportunity. 17 and a half minutes gone, second half. Inside the 22-metre line, slightly to the right-hand side of the posts. Nayavalu doing some good work there in terms of bringing the try around. And Bernard Foley has kicked that one straight between the posts. And we have 58 minutes gone. And it is Australia who are into the lead by 21 points to 20. And it's available here for Australia. The referee playing advantage for Australia, and it's a penalty advantage. They lead by 21 points to 20. And it is now with Will Guinea outside the 22, moves it away. A chance here now, that crossfield kick in behind Zeebo, who looks to go back to try and gather that one. Referee's whistle is gone, and it's going to be a penalty for Australia outside the Irish 22.
Yeah, and again, it's that sweeping Australian attack. And I think if Hillett Petty had released the ball earlier, Dean Mum was coming on a brilliant line. They were certain to score.
And here comes Bernard Foley now with the chance to extend the lead here for Australia, which they barely snatched only about 2 or 3 minutes ago. Just a single point between the teams at the moment, and Foley comes up now and nudges this one. It's gone between the posts. It's a 4-point game for Australia.
Yeah, great attack there from Australia from the kickoff. There was a good kickoff from Paddy Jackson, went deep into the right-hand side corner, but Australia at ease got right outside the Irish defence and turned defence into attack, and was lucky enough that for Ireland that it's only 3 points rather than seven.
The Irish player who got it, that is lifted onto the ground, available here now for Peter O'Mahony. Smashes some fellow out of the way, available here now. I saw Hooper and Pocock tried to poach that one on the ground, back as Ireland carry that one. Good work here by CJ Stander, available for Murray, moves it back to Paddy Jackson, to Josh van der Fleer. Josh van der Fleer, the Irish support runner, slightly isolated as Conor Murray has it now, moves it back, has gone to Peter O'Mahony. Peter O'Mahony batters some fellow out of the way, carries it now to within 7 yards of the Australia line. It's come back there now towards Cian Healy. Cian Healy carries it for Ireland now towards the 5 metre line again, in towards Tadhg Furlong. Tadhg Furlong will open the line, doing untold damage. Back with Conor Murray. Murray moves it back. Chance here now, as Ireland have it now within 5 yards of the Australia line, straight in front of the post. Conor Murray moves it to Zeebo. Pops it out.
Well, that's outstanding play from Ireland, phase after phase, just battering the that Australian defence. The key is quick recycling, brilliant clean out, great hands, backs and forwards combining. Tadhg Furlong held up short, but Alton Delan doing a brilliant clean out. But once the ball, Peter O'Mahony, you can see the venom in him. He's waited for this chance. He's had two massive carries, but a superb play for Keith Earls in the corner.
Great execution by Ireland, and you can see the impact from the bench there straight away, and right back into the game. Real test match on our hands now.
Here comes Paddy Jackson with the conversion opportunity from outside the 22 metre line across on that far side. Ireland by a single point, 25-24, 13 minutes remaining, and Paddy Jackson then with the chance after that try from Keith Earls. And Paddy Jackson comes up now, kicks this one, nudges it towards the post, and that's an absolutely belter of a kick from Paddy Jackson from the touchline, and it gives Ireland the grip on the game again. Scrum for Australia on their own 22 metre line, 10 metres in from the touchline. 3 points between the teams, Ireland by 27-24, the 80 minutes is up. Will Guinea looks to gather that one. Ireland putting the pressure on here, they turn it around, the referee's whistle is gone. It's a penalty for Ireland. Alton Delan gets up and he batters himself into the chest of Kane Douglas, as much as to say, there you are, kid, that's how you do your scrummaging here. Penalty for Ireland on the 22 metre line. Paddy Jackson with the ball in hand, and Paddy Jackson, well, the time is up, the 80 minutes is up, the crowd have erupted as Paddy Jackson gathers that one and he kicks it into touch, and the referee has blown the full-time whistle. Ireland have held on despite being absolutely decimated in terms of injury throughout the course of this game, and deservedly won by the three.
A terrific win for Joe Schmidt's side there at the Aviva Stadium last weekend. 3 wins out of 4 for the Irish men's side during the course of November. On Sunday, the women's side brought the curtain down on their November campaign when the world number one team, New Zealand, were at the UCD Bowl. A disappointing defeat, but certainly lots of positives for the Ireland head coach, Tom Tierney.
Obviously, the scoreline doesn't look very well to anyone at 38-8, especially when you had a 5-3 scoreline at halftime. And, you know, it was just little things that went against us when under fatigue, when the pressure came on. Unfortunately, a number of areas that we were expecting to be a lot more accurate in just left us down, and we were just defending for too long against a quality team like that, who are physically very, very impressive. So it was a long second half, and that was a disappointing thing, that the things that we were really kind of focusing on during the week just let us down. Obviously, set piece and the ruck area.
one of the areas, I suppose, where you found yourself under the pump a little bit in that second half was to cope with the pace when they came in on counter-attack. And, you know, two of their pacey players scored five tries in the entire match.
I know, yeah. That was a disappointing aspect, the fact that, you know, we weren't looking to kick loose ball to them to give them opportunities, because that's exactly what they wanted. Unfortunately, a lot of it was down to the team under pressure, and it was a case of it was a last gasp option to make those kicks. And unfortunately, when they ran back, then they weren't running back at any organised line chase. So it's a very, very hard day when those things happen, because it's just you know especially when the clock has a good bit of time left, you know. So it was a tough second half. It was a huge learning for the girls. I suppose that's exactly what we're going to take out of these three games, the learnings. But going into the into the Six Nations in the new year, now we have to start being very, very organised in who we have and what we're trying to do, and hopefully the disappointment that we've actually suffered here today and last week against Canada, will hold us in good stead.
When you look at the three games, I don't mean sort of collectively, but overall, I mean, from your point of view, there hasn't been a win there yet. I mean, you've been close to practically every team for a long period of every game you've played in.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, obviously we were very, very close to England in the first game, but didn't get the scoreline in our favour. Against Canada, we were under pressure from the word go. But again, today at 5-3 at half time, while everything wasn't going right or wasn't going to plan, we were still in there. But obviously the physical toll in that first half, and then the couple of scores after half time, those critical 5-10 minutes after half time, you know, went against us. And it's a tough one to take from looking at it on the scoreline, because the girls put in so much effort and so much hard work. But we have to take it on the chin. It's not the end of the world. That's exactly, you know, it's no harm to find out about this thing, these teams now in November, because if this was a World Cup, it would be all over now. So we'll take it on the chin. We'll learn from it, and the plan then will be that we come back bigger and better.
So, I mean, you've played the top three teams in the world here over the last couple of weeks. I mean, it's been a success, even judging by the crowd that's here today. I mean, you can look forward to certainly a Six Nations Championship initially with a lot of confidence.
Yeah, we will, absolutely. You know, we'll always go in there to a Six Nations Championship with a realistic hope of being, one, competitive, and two, actually getting the cup. So it's going to take a while. It's going to take a few weeks to process what has happened over the Novembers. Areas that we worked on, areas that we need to improve on, areas that we were good on, and obviously then the squad depth and the squad, creating a player pool that is actually going to be competitive. And you know, it just shows there that, you know, we've a nice bit to go in relation to being competitive against New Zealand, who, you know, were obviously number one ranked for no reason.
UCD Bowl, along with the Kingspan Stadium, will host the Women's Rugby World Cup next August. The event was launched recently in Belfast. During the course of this week, I spoke to the tournament director, Garrett Tuberty.
I think all the teams are looking forward to coming back. They all, both England, Canada and the Black Ferns, enjoyed their stay here. They got a great welcome. They got a great reception from the fans as well, which is really important. And you can see the eagerness as they were leaving. They were dying to come back for it. You know, the UCD Bowl is a fantastic venue. The facilities there are good. We've learned some stuff as well, though, in terms of spectator services that we'll put on for the Women's World Cup when it starts in August. But certainly from the teams, really happy with the facilities, really happy with the welcome that they received, and really looking forward to come back. And, you know, to be fair, we're looking forward to having them back.
And, I mean, given the fact that it was a condensed autumn international window, you know, with the Black Ferns against Canada thrown in there as well, it was a taster for everybody concerned of what to expect.
Yeah, it was. But we've run a couple of events up in UCD before in terms of the Olympic repechage. We had the women's sevens there. We had a World Rugby women's sevens qualifier in August last year. So we're comfortable with it. We've got to know UCD very well, and UCD know us very well. So, we've got a good team working on both sides and on every aspect of it. So from that point of view, it was really helpful to have those autumn internationals, certainly for the people off the pitch, and I'd imagine for the girls on the pitch too.
And from a venue point of view, I mean, it's absolutely ideal, isn't it, given its location and given, you know, all of the on-site accommodation and everything else that's there?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that people don't realise is that we've got to look after the teams when they come over for the Women's World Cup. You know, from the moment that they get to their airport in Auckland or New York or London or Paris or Rome, from the moment they get there until we get them back there. So we're responsible for their flights, for their accommodation, for their nutrition, for their food, their training facilities and all of that. And so from that point of view, it was great to give them a chance to, you know, do recces of the venue, to see what the gym was like, to see what the pool is like, and the facilities in UCD are fantastic. So they're very, very happy, they're very excited, and now the pressure is on to make sure that we deliver.
Now, I know that they will deliver on the pitch. I mean, off the pitch, logistically, it's a huge challenge, I would imagine, in terms of you and your team.
It is, but you know, that's why November was great to have, and the previous events that we had up in UCD were great to have, because you know, we got to know the venue. Sometimes with these things, it's only through hosting teams, getting their feedback, that you can really get a sense of, okay, are there any gaps there? We've identified a couple of issues that we had, but none that are what we'd call showstoppers. Everything's fixable. We've got time to fix it, and we'll make sure we put on a good show for them.
And you've certainly created a huge awareness in terms of numbers, because I mean, I know I was at the England match, I was at the Black Ferns game last weekend. You know, every game you go to, there's a lot more people turning up.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a bandwagon kind of growing behind it, behind the women's team. I think, you know, their success in winning the Grand Slam in 2013, their success in terms of beating New Zealand at the last Women's World Cup, and the interest level is kind of growing beyond what was before, a kind of hardcore group of fans. It's growing beyond that, and we're beginning to see that in increased crowd numbers. You know, we've got a marketing campaign planned for the new year when we go on sale with the pool stage tickets, that we're going to, you know, look to go outside of that group and go into the wider general public to let them know that this is on. Because, you know, this isn't about being women's rugby or men's rugby. This is about rugby. And if you're a rugby fan and you want to support Ireland, then, you know, this is a team that people identify with. Very likeable bunch of players. They're a very committed bunch of players. And this is an opportunity to come to a World Cup in Dublin and in Belfast. So the pool stages will be in Dublin, the knockout stages will be in Belfast, and support the teams. And, you know, that's a great opportunity for families and for parents to bring their kids along to in the summer month.
And how does that actually work? I mean, you say the pool matches are here in Dublin. So is every single pool game here in Dublin with the knockout stages in Belfast?
That's right, yeah. We'll have three match days in UCD. The first match day will be on the 9th of August. We will have six matches in UCD on that day, three in the bowl and three on a separate. We're building a separate stadium, if you like, around Billings Park, one of the pitches there. We'll have a fan zone and, you know, more spectator services, as we kind of say, around it. So match day one, there'll be six matches. That'll be on the 9th of August. Match day two on the 13th of August, again, six matches. Match day three on the 17th of August. And then we'll know the teams will be ranked 1 to 12. 1 to 4 will go into the semi-finals, if you like. And teams 5 to 12 will still play on semi-finals and finals day. They'll still play, but those matches will take place in King's Bank Stadium in Belfast and in Queen's University in Belfast. So the pool stages will all be in UCD, and then the whole show moves up the road to Belfast. This is an all-island tournament. It's really important. We've got the support of both governments, both city councils, and Dunleary right down as well, Dublin City Council and Belfast City Council, all coming behind to make sure that there's a consistent, professional delivery, not just in the venues, but outside of the venues too.
And in terms of a pool draw, the pool draw was made, but the playing schedule on that, when has that become public knowledge?
Well, now that we know the pools following the draw, Rugby World Cup are working with the broadcasters and international broadcasters with a view to exactly finalising when will, you know, we know Ireland will play Australia, we know Ireland will play France, we know Ireland will play the winner of the Asia-Oceania 2 competition, and so what days they'll play and what times they'll play, that will all be known in the next few weeks, and January the 9th is when we have a deadline to announce that to the public and go on sale with pool stage tickets.
And in terms of tickets, where are we there? Are, you know, obviously you're trying to get as many people in there as humanly possible.
Yeah, I think at the moment we're already on sale for tickets for the King's Bank Stadium for the semi-finals and finals day, and sales so far have been encouraging for that. We will go on sale on January the 9th, as I say, with the pool stage tickets. We have a capacity of around 3,000 in the bowl. We'll have a similar capacity in Billings Park in the second pitch in UCD. And that looks about right for us in terms of the way that what we have seen through the past Six Nations and what we've seen through the November internationals in terms of crowd sizes.
So rather exciting. What is it? 6, 7, 8, 9. Might even be 9 months ahead.
Unfortunately, it's not quite. It's about 7.5 months left, and I'm counting down the days a little bit closer than you are. But then again, this is my job, so that's what I got to do. But it's very exciting, and we've got the Six Nations to play before we get into the World Cup. But the World Cup is a great opportunity. It's a great opportunity for us all to come out and support the team. But also, we're engaging with the embassies and getting involved with the expat communities here, from the visiting teams, from the likes of England, Canada, New Zealand and Australia, to get them to come out as well and have that atmosphere in the campus around August 2017. It's going to be very special, and it's going to be, hopefully, one of those I was there moments.
During the course of this week, the Guinness Storehouse hosted the Guinness Rugby Writers Player of the Year Awards. Sene Naupo won the Women's Player of the Year, Clontarf the Club of the Year, the Team of the Year were Connacht, while former internationals Philip Orr and Tony Ward were inducted into the Hall of Fame. Ireland and Munster backrows CJ Stander was voted the Player of the Year.
Yeah, no, it's a great, huge honour, when I started this tradition where I shake and all the reporters' hands, so I'm going to keep on doing that. Maybe I get something else out of it,
It's been a huge squad effort, really, both with Munster and Dean Ireland.
Yeah, look, it's been unbelievable the last few months, I think from a place where we were last year in a bit of a hole, I think everyone put the shoulder to the wheel, and just worked hard. On the Munster side of points, everything is looking great down there. I was at the Māori match, it was unbelievable. And then in the Irish setup, this last November, last few matches, was you're going to look back at this one day and see, tell yourself, that was a month to remember, so it's been unbelievable. I think Chicago was very special. I think that'll be special in everyone's hearts for a long time. And just the way we all got together and worked hard for what we wanted to achieve,
The last 4 or 5 months from an international point of view have been absolutely superb. I mean, starting back in South Africa.
Yeah, I think in South Africa, the first match to go down there and create history was unbelievable, And then the second match and the third match, I think we were a bit disappointed, especially with the second one. But coming back to playing New Zealand and then playing against Australia last week, just getting to that second half where we maybe got to a dip and almost lost the match again, I think that experience from South Africa gave us a huge advantage at the weekend.
Chicago, you've mentioned that already. I mean, that was rather special, wasn't it? It was an incredible week, even.
Yeah, the whole week and everything that happened prior to that week was good, And with everything with the Cubs there and the history that was made there, and us going down there and creating history again, was good. It's something we worked to as a team and as a group. And I think we didn't really have a lot of time to work towards that game, But I think everyone on their own just zone into the game and watch a bit of Champions Cup and see what New Zealand had in their sleeves, and I think it helped a lot, and it just shows that as a collective we could work together and make something out of it.
Now, Ireland have finished the November series, I think ranked number 4 in the world. Obviously the draw for the Rugby World Cup is next May. That's something that's kind of out of your hands, but in terms of opening a new chapter next year, it's a rather exciting year.
Yeah, looking forward to next year. I think this from Six Nations, as I said, in South Africa, we won a few games, but we're still disappointed, and we want to be, as a team, as a group, best in the world, so you can't just compete against the top teams. You need to beat them week in and or series in and out, So I think that's something we're going to strive to and work towards, and just shows the quality and depth we have in the group.
There's no doubt whatsoever that the sad occasion of the death of Anthony Foley's had a huge effect on everybody on and off the field.
Yeah, I think Keith Ells put it into nice words, especially in Munster, that it's a pity that we waited after his passing that we're playing the way he wants us to play, and it just shows what he meant to a lot of players and to a lot of people in Limerick and in Irish rugby and the setup, and I think he touched a lot of people deep in the heart just to go out there and use every opportunity that you get, and it helped a lot, and hopefully we can take that into the future and just keep on playing for the big man.
In the aftermath of that match against Glasgow and the victory, I mean, the fact his two sons were on the pitch with the players and the squad celebrating and marking his life, it showed literally how much his family meant to everybody.
Yeah, very special, I think to have them there next to the pitch and onto the pitch was very, very special. I think that whole week I've seen boys and men cry, and I think that day Everyone just broke down. It was an emotional week, and I think everyone wanted to show the support for the family, because as I said earlier on, Axel meant a lot for me personally and for a lot of players. You know, kept on pushing them in dark times, you know, and selected them when they thought they're not going to make it. And I think everyone's still with the family and in their prayers and in their thoughts, you know, and I think it's going to be for a long while, because he was a big part in everyone's lives. So it was difficult, and it's going to be still, I think, in the next few weeks, the next few months, going to be difficult to go on from there.
And before we finish up, can I just say to you that, you know, in terms of being selected as the Guinness Rugby Writers Player of the Year, when you look at all of the other players you play with, both at provincial level and at international level, there's a lot of competition there.
Yeah, it's as in the beginning, it's a big honour, you know. I googled back and saw a few players who got it before me, and just to see Paulie again up there, and Tommy Bowe and Johnny, all of them got it before me. It's a massive honour, and there's a lot of competition, you know. I'm just humbled to get this award, and as I said, I'm just going to keep on shaking the boys' hands when I see them again.
I'm with Pat Lamb. Pat, I guess picking up an award like this here tonight at the Guinness Rugby Writers certainly brings back some happy memories, I would imagine.
Oh, it sure does. I mean, it's not just for the team. You know, we're honoured to win it on behalf of the West of Ireland, the people of the West of Ireland, and, you know, and that's home and abroad. And I think what came through pretty clearly last year and continue this year is the amount of support that we've had. And then, of course, we appreciate the rest of Ireland. You know, our whole purpose is to inspire our community, but we're fully aware that there's a lot of people that aren't from the West of Ireland that got right behind us as well, and we appreciate it. And it was a wonderful memories for so many people and you know, local and abroad, and it was great to be part of it.
I know that there will be stand-up moments during the course of any year, but can I just reflect on one with you? When you came in on the team bus the day of the final, and the number of people who were literally hanging off the rafters to welcome you to Murrayfield that day?
I never ever experienced that, and I don't think I ever will again. I mean, every single player still talks about it. I know Jerry wrote a book about it, and it was an amazing experience to go through, and the impact that it had to go in there, and I knew I had to regroup the boys about it, but use it and channel it into our performance. And the way we played in that final, a lot of it was due to the support we had, but certainly that moment was a big one.
In terms of channeling the players' energy and emotional energy into what happened on the pitch, I mean, was that I don't want to say difficult, but you understand what I mean, given the fact that fellas could have went, ooh, you know, that there's such a big crowd here.
I think we had the experience of it throughout the season, and there was so many big games, so many games we created history in, so many opportunities that we could use that brought us there. And I know a lot of people commented before the game that, you know, maybe this is going to overawe them. But the fact is, we were pretty much playing big-time rugby finals right through the season and must-win games where people thought that we wouldn't do it because the other teams were full strength, and that held us in good stead. So it just became another big moment of what we've been used to throughout that season.
In terms of this year and the way it's gone so far, obviously, I mean, it's well documented. You know, it probably hasn't gone according to plan, but, I mean, we all know why. I mean, you've come back pretty strongly in the game against Treviso this weekend. It's a pretty big one.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think the biggest thing for us is we continue to be on this journey. I think we look at the Pro 12, we're still, you know, we're at the bottom near the table, but we look at it and we have true belief that we're going to climb into that top six. There's a bit of work involved, but that's still realistic. And then, you know, the Champions Cup games against WAS. I mean, all the work we did last year, the whole sole focus was to get into the Champions Cup. You know, we lead our pool at the moment. The back-to-back WAS games, who are playing extremely well, is massive for us, because we win one, we've got a great chance of getting through. We win two, we're probably through. And that, to me, if Connacht Rugby gets into the last eight of Champions Cup with the best teams in Europe, to me it's equivalent or par of being in the winning the Pro 12. It is that huge. But then we also have the opportunity of test match rugby to get to the final and go from there.
And people wondered how, you know, Connacht would cope dining at the top table, if I can call it that. I mean, we've seen the way you've coped so far this year, but those back-to-back WASP games are immense, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And I think the expectations are high because of what we've done. But the reality is, you know, with what we have compared to what other teams, we are fighting way above our weight. And that's what I'm proud about, the fact that it is a true team effort. I said it many times. It is a, you know, collective. There's so many things going right on and off the field. I'm really pleased that, you know, where we are now from where we were when I first came here, and the amount of work that so many people have done, it's such a great future for Connacht Rugby. And probably the biggest highlight for me, whenever I hear Ireland's call now, you know, I get a little bit emotional when they get about the four strong provinces, because we can truly say that Ireland has four strong provinces, and that's huge.
And before we finish up, I mean, there's no doubt whatsoever that what's happened for Ireland during the course of November is going to filter back, you know, and you must have been so proud of the fact that there were so many people from Connacht involved with what Ireland did over the course of November.
Oh, it is. I mean, Irish rugby is such a great space at the moment, and that's the contribution of so many people from the clubs, you know, from the schools, the clubs, the underage, the 20s doing well, the women doing well, you know, to the you know, right through to the national team. And this is exactly what that Plan Ireland document talk about. It's exactly what, for us, our Connacht strategic plan is about. You know, for us to be at Champions Cup every year, for us to be providing, you know, players to play for Ireland, and we've seen that. And then, you know, and we got a strong representation of Connacht Indigenous players playing. So our document is alive, and that's the key. It's not just sitting away gathering dust. You know, everything in that document, when you read it, it's there for you, and it's alive, and you can look around and see it.
Next year's Six Nations Championship will herald the start of a new point system, which will be trialled across the under-20s, women's and men's competitions. Damien O'Mara has been chatting to the Six Nations Chief Executive, John Feehan.
Basically, it's a very similar scoring system to the World Cup, with the bonus point for four tries, or losing bonus point if you're within 7 points, etc., etc. The key thing for us, though, is we had to maintain and make sure that Grand Slam winner will always win. So we've added an additional number of points for anybody who wins Grand Slam. So in other words, you couldn't win all your games and not win the championship. Mm. You have to be able to win that, because a Grand Slam is a really important thing in the context and history of our championship.
So we're in a situation where people will be familiar with 4 points for a win, a bonus point for a try, 2 points for a draw. You know, you don't get anything if you lose. There is the possibility for losing bonus points. Is this a hard model to apply in a championship where basically the fixtures alternate on a year-to-year basis, that it's not home and away as the Pro 12 or as the Champions Cup would be?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say we're not the same as the other championships. So from that point of view, we've got to be very careful when we introduce anything like this, that we're not adding another layer of inequity, because as you're aware, within the existing structure, some teams will have two home games and some will have three. But we believe that this is a really positive step, and we think it's going to encourage tries, which is actually the most important part of what we're trying to achieve here. It also means that teams right from the off, from the first weekend, will be positive in their approach towards the games, and it's not just a case of creeping through the weeks to try and hit that final weekend.
Are we to take from that overall, you know, maybe is it the first 4 weekends, aside from the deciding day, is there a desire within the Six Nations for maybe more excitement, more free-flowing rugby, for more drama on match days, rather than, let's be very honest, what can very often be a game of chess? It's about getting the victory, whatever way you need to get the victory.
Yeah, I think it's very important that we encourage people to go for the big scores, basically, and more importantly, to try and score tries. So in other words, instead of maybe taking a penalty, they go for a try. I think it's really important. I wouldn't say in any sense that it's been dull or boring in the first four rounds of the championship, but I just think this is a positive encouragement to go and be a bit more positive in your outlook.
What has the reaction been like from within the playing base, or from the coaches across the board, as far as you've been able to ascertain so far? Because presumably the unions are heavily involved in this, because they are the most prominent stakeholders in the championship.
Well, to be honest, we've only just announced it, so it's going to take a little bit of time for that to permeate through. But certainly all the feedback and all the input that we had prior to actually making the announcement was very positive. Mm.
This has been floated time and time again, and I think, I don't know how many Six Nations launches we've asked you the inevitable question about rumours of bonus points, and it didn't appear to be on the agenda early this year. Has it been something that's happened quite quickly in the grand scheme of things, or a decision that's been made, you know, within the most recent weeks or months?
It's one of those situations where after every championship we review what's happened and how it's happened, and, you know, what could we introduce or not introduce, as the case may be. We're doing this on a trial basis for 1 year to start with, to see whether it actually works and achieves the objectives we're looking for it to achieve. I mean, it's very hard to say that this will definitely have the positive outcome that we think it will have. But, you know, we'll review that at the end. And I think on balance, you know, let's be brutally honest, the Six Nations is the biggest and best championship in the world on an annual basis. It is second to none in terms of people watching it, in terms of money it generates, in terms of interest and overall excitement that it generates. So in real terms, you've got to be very careful about how you adapt and change things like that. And we've been very conscious over the years to, you know, probably taking a slightly conservative approach and sort of said, no, this is extremely successful. It is the most successful annual tournament in the world. And we mess with it at our peril, if you like. So we've taken a very long and considered view on this one.
Because when people hear that, they'll wonder, why change a winning formula? Is it just a case of trying to polish it ever so slightly to make it even slightly better? It's about that little percentage increase.
I think you can never stand still. Mm. And you've always got to question yourself and question whether you're doing things right or can you improve things slightly. I mean, if you go back 10, 15 years ago, all the games were at a certain time of the day. It's all changed now, and it's changed for positive reasons. We've more eyeballs. We've about 30% more people watching the championship now than there was even 10 years ago. So from that point of view, it's really important that we evolve rather than necessarily have a revolution. And this is part of that evolution, and we'll see how it goes.
Because there always is a clamour for change. You know, the issue of promotion relegation has been brought up. That, you know, is it difficult to come up with that issue of maintaining tradition and maybe giving people what it is they're looking for or what some people are looking for?
As I said, this is the most successful championship we've got. So at the end of the day, we've got to be very careful that we don't do something that can harm it potentially. We always look at every option or strategy going forward. It's important that we challenge ourselves, but at the same time, we've got to be conscious of the history and tradition of the championship. And I think we are. I don't think this is a fundamental change. I think it's a tweak to try and encourage more positive play.
Was it difficult to get it over the line, or is it something that, you know, the unions have been interested in, have been open to embrace, open to trial?
It's fair to say that there would be mixed views as to whether this is going to be a success or not. I think on balance it probably will be. We're pretty positive about it. We think it's going to encourage positive play. But, you know, that's why we're going to have a review at the end to see did it achieve the objectives we were looking for.
Just to finish, your office is adorned with Lions jerseys, and it's very prominent when we come into reception here in Simmons Court.
One or two Six Nations.
But there's very prominent, you know, Lions against Australia, the All Blacks, South Africa. It's obviously a big year for the players. Everyone wants to stand up, wants to impress Warren Gatland. So can we draw from that, hopefully, that it's going to be a vintage Six Nations, because players, maybe more than they normally do, will leave everything on the pitch?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think all the players know that this is their shop window, and they've got to perform in the Six Nations to hopefully get onto the plane for New Zealand 2017. And not just that, I think overall, I think the Six Nations this year is going to be exceptionally competitive. I think there's any of the teams could win it, or certainly almost all the teams will cause an issue for somebody else. So the reality is it's a very, very competitive table, and it's who knows who's going to win it this year. I mean, Ireland have done very well, but England have done very well. Wales have been in there and been competitive. The French pushed the All Blacks last week. So it's anyone's, really.
Certainly a lot to look forward to for next year's RBS Six Nations Championship. Well, that brings this week's podcast to a close. From myself, Michael Corcoran, and producer Andrew O'Connor, thanks for listening. See you next time.